We're a typhoon-prone area. We are used to the typhoon.
Oh, we've been here for 20 years, but nothing happened to us.
Tacloban kasi ay ano ng bagyo. Bagyuhin talaga ito. Sanay kami sa signal number 1, number 2, number 3.
So we grew up with typhoons, several typhoons in a year. That would be typhoon signal number 2, typhoon signal number 3, but nothing like typhoon signal number 5 like Yolanda. So that was really a shock.
Kasi naman dito sa Tacloban, kasi daanan to ng bagyo lagi. Sanay na kasi kami. Sanay na kami. Sanay na kami sa bagyong malalakas na nag yung Cangcabato Bay na tubig at saka dito sa Pacific Ocean.
San Pedro.
Oo, sanay na kami na nagmi-meet sila sa gitna hanggang dito yung tubig. Nasanay na kami doon. Pero nung Yolanda, iba siya eh.
Iba talaga siya. Kahit yung matatanda sa amin, pakaka-experience pa lang daw nila ng ganong kalakas. Ito na yata yung sinasabing climate change. Kakaiba siya na bagyo. Hindi siya yung ordinary typhoon na nangyayari lang dito sa Philippines or Tacloban.
I saw in the television, the president warning us that there is a typhoon that is really very strong. They already call it super typhoon. But here in our place, when we speak of super typhoon, the previous super typhoon was the scale, the strength of Haiyan. So people here just relax because of our previous experience of a super typhoon. Even myself, they said, after a day or two, things would be normal. I was also complacent.
We were just simply preparing for a very ordinary incident that we used to handle typhoons for that matter. Only to find out that Haiyan, based on forecast, was very much strong compared to the previous preparations that we gave.
That was the first time I encountered such a strong, would I say, strongest typhoon. Yolanda was a history, actually.
From Princeton University's Blue Lab, this is Carried by Water. I'm Mario Soriano.
And I'm Braden Carroll, the audio engineer working behind the scenes to bring Season 1 of Carried by Water to you. This time, I'm jumping into the discussion myself.
I'm so glad our listeners finally get to hear your voice this episode, Braden.
Happy to be here.
This episode, we'll talk about the importance of preserving the stories and lessons learned from Typhoon Yolanda for future generations. We'll also learn about different visions and aspirations for resilient shelter, and hear about disaster trauma and the roles of culture and ritual in collective healing. Episode 6,
We Are Used to Storms.
Part 1, Memory and Memorialization. In our fieldwork for this project, one of the first places we visited was the Manila Observatory in Quezon City. It was founded by the Jesuits in 1865, and in 1884, it was formally designated by the Spanish Crown as the official institution for weather forecasting in the Philippines. Of course, today that designation belongs to PAGASA, but the Manila Observatory still does a lot of research related to weather and climate.
Its archives are particularly interesting since there are weather records dating back to the late 1800s. For example, we saw this account of an 1849 storm in Samar recorded by the priest Father Miguel Selga. He was describing how the storm destroyed all the crops in his town, and the tale of a man in a small boat, which, quote, the wind took from him, sending him out to sea, almost enveloping him with the waves, end quote.
Anyway, we also got to interview the archivist Mariel Uy. We asked her what archiving these old documents involves.
First, we put each material, we put them on folders. And then if it's too brittle, we put in between acid-free papers. And then we put all those processed materials inside acid-free boxes. And then we maintain the temperature, humidity of the area. And of course, you regularly check. So you inventory for missing pages. If there are mites, usually bookworms, you check for molds and all that.
Marielle seemed excited about her job.
For me, it's fun. For other people, they think that it's so dirty out there and you don't want to touch it. But for me, it's interesting when you find something from a really dirty box. I call them treasures. There are treasures underneath that I feel happy when I see those things because they have a potential to give more stories. So those are the nice things to discover from those boxes.
One of those forgotten stories is an 1897 storm that was eerily similar to Typhoon Haiyan in terms of path and strength.
Scientists tried to compare what happened to Yolanda with the Alge manuscript coming from an archivist perspective. And the similarities is very scary at some point because it's 1897 that summer late account and then Yolanda. The gap is so big and yet it still happened. So yeah, you know that it will really repeat itself. History will repeat itself.
We talked about this exact same storm with Lea Soria back in episode 2. She did some computer simulations which showed that this 1897 storm would have generated devastating storm surges in Leyte and Samar as well. Turns out, Haiyan really was a repeat of history.
We asked Marielle to imagine what if a Yolanda-like superstorm were to hit the archive.
So I guess on the disaster management perspective, yeah, in archiving, what you do is you have your records here, but you try to keep copies of those on a separate, on an offsite area. So we have copies of our digitized collection in the Rizal Library. So if things happen, if really as devastating as the war from 1940s, yeah, where we lost almost 20,000 to 30,000 published materials of the observatory, then it's difficult to get back. But because most of our collection is already digitized, so there's a sort of assurance or sort of just a small part that we can still have those materials, we can see them.
Almost 30,000 materials lost during the Second World War. We'll never be able to recover the knowledge and the stories that they had.
That's true. But that also just shows why archives are so important. They give us an opportunity to learn from the past.
One of the important things of archiving is so that we can give access to people. If you only preserve a material and you don't give access to it, then it defeats the purpose of preservation. So basically, the importance of all these records is to give access and give people resources for them to make a story out of the history, to give a picture of what you can still do in the future.
Right after this visit to the archives, we went to a restaurant to meet with two photographers. The first is Aaron Vicencio, a documentary photographer, geographer, and director of the Eugenio Lopez Jr. Center for Multimedia Communication.
My field of interest is home. How do we picture, imagine, photograph home? And the many intricacies and poetics of home itself. For geographers, space and place mean differently. Space is where things happen. Place is where meaning comes from. So when you are displaced, you are removed from a place of meaning. Your rhythms become removed from that location. So how then do I translate that feeling into an image? That's always my challenge.
Themes of home and displacement definitely became through lines for this project, especially in the episodes dealing with relocation of the survivors.
The second person in this meeting was photojournalist turned documentary photographer Vijay Villafranca.
As a photojournalist, I would cover the aftermath of the typhoons, when I decided to make the shift from full-time photojournalism to documentary photography, I was more conscious of how photographers would visualize disaster, war, conflict. I was more conscious in deconstructing this idea of looking at devastation. And apart from that, try to dig deeper, put more context into the experiences of the communities.
When we asked what was the most memorable to them about Haiyan, Aaron recalled the deluge of images on social media.
It's how it was shared on social media. If I remember correctly, that was peak Twitter following. From a photographer's standpoint, it's viewing the pain of others. Susan Sontag, there's a fascination of something visceral that's happening in front of you through a screen, but it's people suffering. The physical, the visceral nature of Yolanda itself was so painful that even through a screen, it translates.
He noted that the public concern stopped at some point, as if people had become numb to the suffering. Yolanda had passed from being something extraordinary to something ordinary.
Right now, it isn't the same concern. We look into it as it's a normal, everyday occurrence. The magnitude of concern and care sometimes disappears. So for me, that's something that we need to take into account when we look into how we are able to encapsulate and remember our own disasters.
For Vijay, one thing that stood out to him was how a specific word was being thrown around, resilience. He said he tried to re-examine the irresponsible use of resilience in Cygnos, a book compilation of his images from storm-devastated areas from 2009 to 2015. One image from the aftermath of Typhoon Haiyan stands out.
I think for me, at least in the context of my work with Cygnos, this is an image that I will never forget, especially the story behind it. So this is an image of a man holding a clock. The clock stopped at around 7:43, 4. The story behind that is that the man had three kids in this house in Tanawan, in Leyte. And during the onslaught, he had left the kids in the house for safety, thinking that it was the safer ground. And he had to go and get, I think, the wife. I can't remember the exact details, but he went out. But long story short, he wasn't able to make it back. So the kids was carried by the surge and didn't survive. He and his wife survived. And what was left of their house is this clock. So this is the time when the water reached the wall. So it short-circuited the clock, I guess. But the clock was just there. And surprisingly, the clock was left on the wall with this time and with the mud and all that. So yeah, until today, I can't forget this man. I would remember the house if I go back to Tanawan. So I think because also of a few things. I mean, generally how time stops when you take a photograph or you take a slice of time whenever you take a photograph to be sort of philosophical about it. But just generally the experience of documenting trauma always comes to mind when I see this image, because some people would say time heals all wounds, but not all wounds are healed, even if time passes by.
Aaron added his thoughts on the emotions behind photographs of disaster.
We're two professional photographers, but what of those people who lost their family photos? I think that's even more valuable. What of the other photos that were there beside the clock? What were those images? Maybe those were lost. There are certain images that haunt our memories, and the more that we look into those photos, doesn't make it easier. Looking again and again actually compounds the emotions of what was going through when you took those photos.
Another archive of the profound sense of time and memories lost in an instant is the anthology Lunop, Haiyan Voices and Images, published by the Leyte Samar Heritage Society and the National Commission for Culture and the Arts. We spoke to the executive editor for the book, the cultural scholar and professor at the University of the Philippines Tacloban College, Joyce Dorado Alegre.
We have a word for search, dulok or lunok.
But that's no longer used because there was never such in the last 85, 50 years. It's never used. People understand more tsunami, which is Japanese, right?
It's a bit loud because we were in this bustling cafe called Rovinare. The word Rovinare is taken from the Italian word rovine, which means ruins. It was a former ice plant that was completely submerged in water during Haiyan. The decor repurposed debris from the storm into furniture and fixtures.
There's definitely something inspiring about how they turned remnants of destruction into beautiful art pieces. Going back to Joycey, she said producing the anthology was one way of making sure people would never forget about Haiyan, the way its historical precedents were forgotten.
It happened 100 years ago, but we didn't know about it. Why didn't our elders, you know, why didn't this become part of our oral stories? Maybe it's there, but there is no consciousness about being prepared. Why is there such a gap? So we don't want that to happen. So we have to document. We have to document.
I love the way she wrote it in her preface to the book. Quote, "Because we thought it was just like any other bagyo of our childhood, that we would simply wade up, laughingly welcome it with a tagay of tuba, like we would an old friend returning home. Because of reasons in the recesses of our knowing and unknowing, we bring forth to the post-Haiyan light our voices and images in these pages and in the silences beyond." End quote.
Joycey recounted the personal emotional toll of chronicling these stories. After all, she herself was a typhoon survivor.
I was the editor and was processing everybody's narratives. I was going through like hundreds of photographs. Out of hundreds, going through my eyes, which ones to include and not to include. And since I'm an artist, all these images, it's a barrage of images. So if everybody has ceased crying, I was still crying a year after. So I went through that process. So every narrative that I read is a grieving on my part. It's always painful.
Despite these complex emotions, Joycey knew her mission was important to save future generations. Quoting again from the book, "So that when it happens again, we would no longer be nonchalant nor ill-prepared, and thus decimated. So that we would face another superstorm head-on, with knowledge and skills for survival and sustaining life after it passes."
Part 2. Shelter from the Storm.
Joycey says it's hard to be convinced that people have learned their lessons, though.
Where are the evacuation centers? They're supposed to be towers because these are surges. If there are surges, where would people go? Evacuation centers should be wide, spacious towers to house thousands of people. Where are the towers?
So we actually did visit one evacuation center that was constructed after Haiyan. One that was built by a humanitarian organization.
That was the one up on the hill in Tacloban, right? That didn't look like it could hold thousands, but its high elevation would definitely protect people from storm surge at the coast.
Yes, that evacuation center up on the hill was sponsored by the United Nations Development Program for the surrounding resettlement sites like the UNDP village. Constructing evacuation centers was a priority for a number of NGOs to help communities prepare for future disasters.
So what goes into designing an evacuation center? To find out, we spoke to Pamela Kahilig, who you might remember from episode 2. She's an anthropologist, architect, and volunteer who worked with a women's rights NGO after the typhoon to co-design an evacuation center.
We made sure that we chose an architect who had experience in evacuation, so our architect was from Baguio. And her family was evacuated during the Baguio earthquake. So she lived in an evacuation center for about 3 months as a child. and it was something that she brought into the experience. The initial design that she presented to the community was fine. The only comment that they had was there were too many big windows made of glass. And in their experience, evacuating for Typhoon Yolanda, a lot of women got injured. Maybe some people were even killed because the wind was so strong that it broke the glass in the shelters where they were at.
This approach of listening to the input of intended users appears to have been a central tenet for NGO-sponsored projects.
So when building an evacuation center, designers need to consider not just the structure itself, but also other issues like gender.
So one of the things the women that we talked to kept saying is that they're the ones who are tasked to cook out of the canned goods that they receive. They're the ones who are tasked to wash the clothes that they receive. You know, all these care responsibilities that are assigned to women by society, of course, are magnified in an evacuation context. So we call it a gender responsive evacuation center because we made sure that there were multiple washing facilities, multiple cooking facilities, and also multiple toilets for LGBTs who are evacuated, because their experiences in evacuation, they get thrown out both men's and women's toilets. So they also needed a safe space in that sense. So that's how we integrated the gender issues.
Okay, so an evacuation center needs to be in a safe location, be structurally sound, and responsive to feedback from the intended users on issues like gender and accessibility.
Well, as an undergraduate studying civil engineering, I had the privilege of getting to talk to one of the leading figures in post-Haiyan research around resilient construction and strong building practices.
That's my college professor in structural engineering, Dr. Jaime Hernandez.
Here's some highlights from our conversation.
So you want to be a civil engineer, right? Okay, this is going to be your first civil engineering lecture. The resistance of a structure should always be greater than the demand on the structure. So resistance is strength, demand would be load. Okay, so that's what you want to do so that it's safe. So the resistance is always greater than the demand. So normally when engineers design structures, they would focus on the resistance part. If you want to strengthen a structure, normally you would put a larger member, you would put stronger materials, things like this. Okay, that would be resistance. Okay, a lot of engineers don't realize that there's the other side of the equation. There's the demand equation. If you can somehow reduce the demand on your structure, then you're actually keeping the structure safe as well by doing that.
Interesting. So if a building is at risk of experiencing extreme conditions, the solution might be to try to minimize the impact of these conditions in the first place.
Exactly. So then the question is, if there are high winds or severe floods, how can engineers design buildings to channel these destructive forces away?
Well, we build our structure in ways where the wind would flow easily through the building, or I mean around the building, without causing it to generate a lot of forces. The main concept is really to redirect the wind. A classic example is a bridge. The bridge deck is normally made up of a rectangular section, right? So when you have a rectangular section, the wind passing in this direction will just blow on that and it will sway as a consequence. Bridge engineers, what they do is they shape the sides of the bridge so that instead of having a flat face, you have a curved face where the wind could just flow and be redirected. And that would lessen the force that is generated by the wind. So concepts like this, you know, if we can apply them to structures, to our houses, for example, well, we can improve the performance of the structure itself by just reducing the demand instead of just strengthening the structure.
What's important about this kind of load-minimizing design is that it requires less material than older designs might, and in doing so can save money on construction. As storms become more frequent and or severe, implementing efficient building practices will be critical in keeping people safe with available resources.
So can storms create forces so large that even efficient building techniques can't create a strong enough structure within a reasonable budget?
Well, unfortunately, yes. One aspect of Haiyan that was particularly devastating to infrastructure was the storm surge. A wall of water soaring meters into the sky puts even the strongest structures at risk of being destroyed, even if costly reinforcements and extra supports are added. Professor Hernandez told us about discussions of whether preparing for these surges is even worth it in the first place.
Our structures are not built for storm surges, the type that was caused by Yolanda. I think there's still a debate going on should we build structures that are able to resist that much force? Because economically, I think a lot of people would say no, especially since if you consider the return period, you know, it could be 50, 100 years, a lot of people will say, well, why put so much resources on that? Could be placed on something else. If that's the thinking, then I would say that, okay, if we're not going to do this, we're not going to build stronger and that could resist that much load, then let's make sure that we have a system that would warn the people and then evacuate them to areas that are safe from the hazard.
Areas that are safe from the hazard don't just mean modern structures. Some of our interviewees shared stories about traditional evacuation strategies that saved lives during Haiyan. Carmi Makapagao, an NGO volunteer we met in Giwan, told us about a traditional structure they used for evacuation in her hometown of Homonhon Island.
Meron kasi kaming parang traditional na ginagawa, kulong.
We have this traditional system called kulong. Some barangays prepared that. Up in the mountains, you dig a hole, put up some kind of roof. That's where you'd hide when the storm comes. A traditional form of evacuation, like an island adaptation. Back in the day, concrete houses weren't very common in Homonhon Island. It's very far, 3 to 4 hours by boat from the main Giwan town. So the kulong has been an important evacuation strategy.
Parang pinaka-evacuation area, ayun, yung kulong.
We were supposed to visit Homonhon, right?
Yes, unfortunately, Super Typhoon Egay had other plans.
Oh, that's right.
The Coast Guard wasn't allowing boats to go out to sea because of the storm.
So how do kulongs work?
So parang basically hukay siya sa lupa na...
It's basically just a hole in the ground. It's not that deep. Just deep enough for people to sit down. Then you'd put some sort of roof on top as a shield from the wind and rain. The roof isn't high. It's very close to the ground, so that the wind doesn't blow it away. Of course, you'd make a kulong in an area surrounded by trees that can shield you, not in a barren land where you'd be fully exposed to the wind.
Carmi also told us that these have to be on a slight slope so that any debris that falls on top can just roll down and not trap you inside. Here's another local strategy we learned in the field. Remember the boatmaker we heard from last episode, Eddie? He told us he and his family evacuated to a cave in Marabut, Samar, after local authorities warned them about the coming storm.
The local police here went around to warn people. They told us to prepare as the wind might get stronger. It was still early, about 10 in the morning. We were already in the cave up there in the mountain. That's where we hid. We brought some food, a few pieces of clothing, and the children. At around midnight, the wind started to blow. And at 3 a.m., it was already really strong. There were probably about 30 families in that cave. There were many of us. If we had nowhere to hide, we would have all been wiped out. I said, thank goodness we have this space to hide. If not, probably none of us would be left alive.
Wala na tayong buhay na matitira.
So, caves turned out to be these natural evacuation centers that people have been using in this typhoon-prone region.
Is Eddie talking about the cave we visited on the way out of Giwan? The one with the weavers?
No, that one was the Saob Cave. Saob wasn't used as an evacuation center during Yolanda, but it was used as such during Typhoon Ruby, which hit the region in 2014. At the Saob Cave, we spoke to Julita Abal, who has been weaving for almost 60 years. We heard from her that traditional weavers have long taken advantage of the humidity and temperature in the cave that were ideal for tikog, their traditional grass material.
Para sa amin na mga taga rito, yung mga, lalo na yung mga weavers, malaking tulong ito. Kasi unang-una, dito kami gumagawa dahil pag dito ka talaga maggawa, focus ka talaga sa gagawin mo sa pag-weave. Tapos yung pangalawa, pag mainit, dito talaga kami. Kasi mas maganda dito para sa materials namin. And then, hindi lang sa weaving area, naging tourist destination din itong cave namin. And then, nung magbagyo ng Ruby, na nagtagal, maraming family na nag-evacuate dito, doon banda. Nagawala kami ng hagdan na kahoy. Doon, no, 14 families yung nakakumulit doon sa taas. Kaya, mahalaga ito sa amin.
Okay, so here Julita gave several reasons why the cave was very important for the weavers and for the community in general. The cave environment was good for the traditional materials and conducive to focusing one's attention on weaving. During Typhoon Ruby, 14 families used the upper areas of the cave as an evacuation center. Finally, the cave has also become a place that tourists visit, so the weavers were now able to sell their products directly.
After we had finished taking a tour of the cave, we got a chance to admire the bags and mats the weavers had crafted for sale. The intricate patterns and striking colors made for a beautiful display.
That's true. Actually, these patterns were the inspiration for the book cover of the Lunop anthology that we mentioned earlier. I met with Dan Matutina, the Tacloban-born designer who put that together.
Honestly, when I was designing that book cover, parang medyo I was running out of ideas. Kasi parang, how do you design a book cover that talks about the memories of the typhoon of Yolanda without being too overly dramatic? Because what happened was really traumatic. But my thinking was that the cover shouldn't show destruction or shouldn't show, alam mo yun, like a typhoon hayan. Parang meteorological map. I was just looking at the photos, and then I saw a photo of the banig na mas spiral and circular. I thought it was a perfect cover for the book.
Dan said the circular banig or mat reminded him of the eye of a typhoon, while also representing a traditional craft of the Leyte and Samar regions. He also told me that the spiral shape captured for him the mixing of multiple, complicated emotions enshrined in the anthology. Part 3. Ritual and Recovery. Producing a podcast is a modern approach to telling stories about the past to convey lessons in preparation for the future. But storytelling itself has long been deeply ingrained in Filipino culture. In Leyte and Samar, the Warais would often gather round in a circle to tell stories after a long day of work, partaking tuba, a local palm wine. As the drinks flow, the stories flow with them.
Some of my fondest memories of our work in the field are from the meetings and interviews we conducted in these informal, more relaxed settings. Jake Palami, the entrepreneur-turned-truck bar owner we met last episode, told us about his efforts at creating such shared spaces for people to gather, recount, and remember their shared experiences years after the truck bar served its last drink.
Years after that as well, we would organize like storytelling sessions. So we would invite different storytellers, and just so they can share their stories. That's it. Over to Va at one time. We thought, okay, it's up to us to make sure that not only the world remembers us, but also we, the people living here, remember these stories. I'm sorry. I don't know, I feel so passionate about it. Personally, it's hard to even remember details of the story. Like when you ask me now, I wouldn't remember all of it, but then there's some kind of guilt associated with it. Like, oh, I wish I remember, you know, I wish I remembered everything. I wish I remember all the dead, all the loved ones that we lost every day. But then you don't, because then you have to move on.
Telling stories of the past is also about memorializing the departed, honoring their lives, and ensuring that they never fade from memory.
For many of the officials and researchers we spoke to, honoring the dead meant doing their jobs better. I think this sentiment was best captured by Mahar Lagmay, the disaster scientist who leads the Nationwide Operational Assessment of Hazards, or NOAA. We met him way back in episode 2.
Seeing people dead on the streets, it's a hard sight to look at. But I do that on a year-to-year basis. I've counted thousands of bodies, looked at their faces. We've become hardened already looking at this because this is the type of work that we do, trying to learn the lessons at ground zero. And that kind of challenge has actually translated into getting us to do more, because we know that these people who have perished don't have voices anymore. And the work that we do actually is some kind of way by which we can vent out what they would have wanted to say, which they cannot do anymore because they're dead. They have perished. So that has inspired us to do more. A way of trying to rectify things that went wrong, mistakes that should not be repeated.
For the faithful, prayers for the departed were an important part of their deliverance.
What you heard there are soundscapes from churches we visited in 2023. The 6 o'clock prayer in Giwan's Immaculate Conception. Kyrie eleison in Tacloban's Santo Niño. A wedding at the Palo Cathedral. Voices and music of hope and celebration. All of these churches were severely damaged by Typhoon Yolanda. The soundscapes would have been very different in the aftermath of the storm. Some of the most moving images from the period were of people gathering for prayer inside debris-laden and roofless churches.
Having lost everything, faith was one thing people could cling to process the grief they were going through. Joyce Alegre told us about the importance of prayers and rituals for the dead in Waray culture.
We have to think of the rituals, proper rituals. We have rituals for the dead, but we don't have the rituals for a collective dead, like thousands. What do we do with thousands of dead?
Joycey told us that rituals function as a way to keep people balanced. They help people manage transitions between different life stages, whether that's birth, marriage, or death. She and her team worked with the church to devise rituals for collective grieving that were also rooted in local customs.
Death is very difficult to manage, even if it is expected. So much so for death that is very shocking, like the death by way of a natural cataclysm. And the Waray culture is very rich with rituals for the dead. For example, on the day of the death, there will have to be prayers. On the third day, pray again. On the ninth day, prayers. On the 40th day, prayers. And there is the cycle of 1 year. That's called the tagmo. Then you have prayers. And for all of these prayers, there is always food offered for the dead, food for people who participate. And that helps. So it's really a series of farewells, both for the living and for the dead. It's a way of cutting the connection, but in a very gentle way. So we have a very elaborate culture that is filled with rituals in every stage of life. And if this is not factored in, it is very difficult to regain a sense of order again.
She told us that the commemoration goes on every year after death. Rituals called tapos. Something that emerged after Yolanda is that the rituals evolved to encompass not just memorializations of the dead, but also celebrations of life for those who survived.
So it has become like that, a massive ground zero tapos. But we also celebrate our lives, that we survive, that we can go on. So it's a combination of both life and death, celebrating life and memorializing the dead. It's a new kind of commemorative event. It's new. And it has been going on for the past 10 years. So it's the making of a new ritual.
Joycey told us that these new rituals of both death and life after Yolanda manifested differently in every community. They generally involved prayers, singing, lighting of candles, and offerings of food and flowers, depending on what the community wanted. As a scholar of culture, she described these rituals as interesting. As a typhoon survivor, she called them beautiful.
Flowers and lamp lights, really beautiful. All these memorials. We have the memorial monuments, but there are also memorial events that are very, very varied. It's a way of coping. It's beautiful.
Carried by Water is a production of Blue Lab at Princeton University. This episode was produced by me, Mario Soriano.
And me, Braden Carroll.
With support from Patrick Alhoco. It was mixed by Braden Carroll.
We'd like to thank everyone who shared their stories with us this season, especially the survivors of Typhoon Yolanda. Thanks to our friends at the Princeton Filipino Community Undergraduate Club,
Isa Sabedo,
and
Enzo Kaw,
for providing voiceovers for this episode.
For their support and expertise, we also thank the High Meadows Environmental Institute, the Princeton Humanities Council, the Office of the Dean of Research, as well as Kuvenda Media. We would also like to thank the High Meadows Environmental Institute's Kathy Hackett, Stacy Christian, Emily Armitage, Zach Cato, Heidi Mihalik, Laura Matecha, Raj Chokshi, Steve Napa, Ryan Juskus, and Nathan Jesse. At Blue Lab, we thank Jamie Collins, Nate Ochin, Juan Manuel Rubio, Jessica Ng, Acela Perez Ortiz, Gemma Sawell, Kira Morris, and Diana Little. Allison Carruth is the director of Blue Lab, and Baron Bixler is the creative director.
Visit our website, bluelab.princeton.edu, for more information and photographs for this episode.
This is our final main episode for this season of Carried by Water. But stay tuned because we have a very special bonus episode on resilience coming up. We'll hear exactly what people have to say about this contested term. So, until next time,